You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Camilla Shamsie's latest novel, Burned Shadows, spans cultures, generations, and nearly a half a century as it traces the journey of a Japanese woman who's been scarred both mentally and physically by the atomic bombing at Nagasaki. Ms. Shamsie was on the show in November to discuss the book, which was shortlisted for the Orange Prize for Fiction, and we thought that we would re-air that conversation for you again today. On the cover of the novel is a picture of a woman revealing her back, and I began by asking Camilla Shamsie, how did Hiroko Tanaka, the protagonist of your novel, get the scars on her back?
You know, the moment I knew I was going to write the story of this woman was when I was reading John Hersey's Hiroshima, which of course is the first account of an American journalist writing about what happened there. And he had this detail in there which was both terrifying and yet so vivid, which was that women who were wearing white kimonos with dark patterns on them at the moment of the bomb, the white reflected the heat off away from their bodies, and the dark patterns absorbed it into the skin, so they ended up with tattoos on their skin in the shape of these kimono patterns.
These are natural tattoos, in effect.
Yeah, they are, and horrific, and you can actually, I almost didn't believe it, and you can find these grotesque pictures. And as soon as I read that, I just had this image of a woman with three bird-shaped burns on her back.
And they're referred to as birds. I'm wondering if that metaphor symbolizes both, is not only about Hiroko, but the novel in general.
Well, you know, the crane, the birds specifically are cranes, and the crane, of course, in Japan now is sort of a symbol of peace. And on the anniversary of the day of the bomb, there are lots of sort of paper cranes made. I wanted it to be something beautiful made grotesque, just to, in some ways, add to the horror. But there is, I think, within the novel, a tension between this idea of flight and freedom on one hand, and then something quite horrible and violent pulling people back or sort of searing them in a certain way.
And the novel covers, goes to five countries, mm-hmm. 60 years,
yeah.
Starts on August 9th, 1945, the date of the bombing of Nagasaki, and concludes in the wake of 9/11 in this country.
Yeah, the final section is New York and Afghanistan in 2002. And I really didn't know when I was starting out that it would end up there. I thought it would end up with India and Pakistan, nuclear-armed rivals.
So you knew you wanted to do something about nuclear armament?
Yeah, that's how it sort of started. And it was, I mean, it was always going to be about these personal lives intersecting with history and how sometimes people manage to ride the wave of history, and other times it knocks them over completely.
Well, Hiroko seems to have an uncanny knack for being present during major historical events or being related to someone who does.
You know, I've had a couple of people say that to me, and I just think in terms of my own family history. And I think actually, to me, it's sort of fairly normal for someone to have lived through the Second World War and partition and the 71 war in Pakistan. And so in my family stories, there are, you know, stories that have to do with these grand moments and people's lives being very directly affected with it. And if you live in Pakistan, history is always breathing down your shoulder. So, I mean, it's always there in anyone's life.
Well, this country has been involved with most of the major events of history of the, at least mm-hmm. the second half of the 20th century, maybe the whole 20th
right.
century up till now.
Yeah.
And yet we, unless it's something like 9/11, which occurs on our shores, we feel a certain distance from it. But there's a difference when you're right there.
There is a difference. And there's some way in which, you know, as a Pakistani growing up in Pakistan in the 80s, I was more aware of a certain aspect of America's history than most Americans were, because it was happening in Afghanistan. And I was much more aware of the direct impacts of it.
Now, we're talking about Pakistan. Hiroko Tanaka is Japanese mm-hmm. in Nagasaki, so we have to get her from Nagasaki to India and then Pakistan. She lost her German fiancé in the bombing And then wound up going to New Delhi.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was that common? Obviously, Japanese and Japan and Germany were allies during World War II.
One of the things I discovered in my research that Nagasaki was a very cosmopolitan city at a certain point, and for a long time was the only place in Japan that had any interaction with Europe, which made that as a location for the bomb particularly horrifically ironic. But there were quite a number of Germans in Japan during the Second World War. All other Europeans were expelled, but because the Germans were allies, there were still not huge numbers, but there was a German presence.
Why were his relatives living in New Delhi?
He has a half-sister who's married to an Englishman. She's half English, half German. And of course, it's the last days of the British Raj.
Well, most of the characters in this novel are living emigre lives. That's obviously one of the themes here,
mm-hmm.
too.
In every section, the four countries that it's mainly in, there's Japan, there's India, Delhi, there's Pakistan, and then there's America. And in all four sections, you have someone who is living in the place who's grown up there, and then you have people from outside coming in. So it is this interaction.
Well, she arrives in India not long before partition, and partition disrupted the lives of millions of people.
Absolutely.
A lot of people died, but many mm-hmm. people moved from India to Pakistan, others from Pakistan to India.
Mm-hmm. That's right, and her family gets caught up in that as well, or her personal life gets caught up in it. And again, as I said, that was a story I grew up with because for my grandparents' generation, it was very vivid. And even my parents were both of them were already born, so they have these fleeting memories of partition.
But had they been born somewhere else and been forced to move after partition?
One of my grandmothers was actually German, so she, much like Hiroko, had this very traveling life where she went from Germany to India and then at partition moved to Pakistan. But all four of my grandparents moved from India to Pakistan.
How long before partition was no longer a real problem for people and their adjustment to the way where they had to live?
Well, those are two separate, you know, my family, half the family is still in India, half is in Pakistan. So when, you know, my grandmother couldn't get a visa to go and see her dying mother. That in the 60s, of course, was still a vital issue. So partition, partly because the two countries still have this disputed area of Kashmir, in some ways it's never entirely gone away because that question of where are the boundaries, that question still lingers.
After Hiroko moves to India, the novel really becomes a story of two families. One, the Muslim family that Hiroko has married into, and the other, the German-British family of her late fiancé. Were there a lot of biracial families living in Pakistan at that time, in Karachi?
Quite a number. As I said, for one thing, I had my grandmother, but there are certainly, even today, you'll find quite a lot of Japanese women and Pakistani men.
Japanese women, many moved there?
Well, you had, again, not many, but of course, if you're working on a novel about something, you see it wherever it is. I think in the 80s, you had a lot of Pakistani businessmen going to Japan, falling in love, getting married. but yes, I mean, quite a few of my friends have mothers who are English or German or some other European country. And
well, they can live in the same city, but they also live in different worlds.
Well, men and women often do.
Well, class alone separates people anywhere you go. And
sure.
I get the sense in this novel that mm-hmm. these two families are living in totally different worlds.
They are, for very many reasons. They're living in different histories. They're living in different power structures. And the family in Pakistan is middle class. The family in the British family is upper middle, which is a sort of significant difference. No one's quite sure what to make of Hiroko because when she comes from Japan, they can't place her in terms of class. And to the Englishman particularly, it bothers him because he's so used to knowing where someone fits and how to treat them based on class alone.
Hiroko has a son named Raza. What leads him to become an activist?
Well, he doesn't really become an activist. He's a slightly lost boy with aspirational parents, or rather an aspirational father, and he's failing an exam. And he feels like a bit of a loser. But the other thing about him is he's growing up, his particular neighborhood in Karachi, it's unusual to have a foreign mother. He doesn't look recognizably Pakistani, so he has these feelings of being an outsider. And when he starts failing his exam, this sense of being somehow not quite belonging is exacerbated. And then he meets a young Afghan refugee. And of course, in the 80s, there were millions of Afghan refugees coming into Pakistan. And because of his mix of Pakistani and Japanese looks, he looks in a certain manner that allows this Afghan boy to think that he is from the Hazara tribe. And for Reza, it's sort of a game at first to go along and pretend to be an Afghan. And then, of course, he can't control it. And the next thing he knows is he thinks he's going on a bit of a holiday, and he's really going to a training camp of Mujahideen along the border.
You quote, your title, in fact, comes from something written by Sahir Latianvi, mm-hmm. is it?
Yes.
Who is Sahir Latianvi?
He's a progressive Urdu poet and a very significant one. The poem that comes from refers in some ways to the actual bomb. It's in past wars, only bodies burnt, but next time even shadows will ignite. And I just thought it was I had the title already, and then a friend of mine said, oh, is that from the Ludhianvi poem? Because that image of burnt shadows is in there.
And you wound up translating it. I've always wondered about growing up bilingual, as mm-hmm. you did. I'm sure you were speaking English when you were young, but also speaking Urdu. Does one affect... You write in English.
English has always been a much, much stronger language. Because I went to a school which was an English medium school, and I spoke English with my parents and my friends. So my Urdu is actually much weaker. So I think in English and I dream in English.
Well, Salman Rushdie talks about growing up in a household where a kind of a pidgin Urdu English mm-hmm. was spoken. The sentence might be in English, but half the words might be in Urdu.
Yes, I don't even notice if I'm with Pakistani friends and you know, a few words here and there will be in one language or the other. Of course, it gives you, you know, just that many more concepts in some way. And words have a different weight in different languages. And sometimes, you know, there will be that occasion where I know a character is saying something in Urdu and the word they're using, even if I can translate into English, it won't carry quite the same weight. So there are always sort of interesting ways of thinking when you're doing this. Of course, in this book, people are trilingual and quadrilingual, and some of them speak languages I don't even know, like Japanese.
The title of the last section of the book, The Speed Necessary to Replace Loss, was derived from The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje, another person who writes in exile. But that was also about someone scarred in war.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reminded in thinking about Hiroko's scars of Toni Morrison's Beloved, where she describes her protagonist's scars from slavery. Do you think that historians too often overlook the people who've been scarred by circumstances beyond their control?
I think the gaze of history is much broader, whereas the novelist will look at individual cost, which of course is not individualistic because, you know, we could be talking millions of individuals. And I think sometimes the historian... in writing about a moment, for one thing, there'll often be a sort of, you know, the great men of history who made the choices kind of narrative rather than the people who were affected.
Well, when I read about Nagasaki and Hiroshima, I read about people who were, you know, had terrible radiation mm-hmm. sickness. And what I don't read about is people who had the patterns on their clothing tattooed on their bodies.
Right. Well, although, you know, I did get that from a nonfiction writer, from John Hersey. But again, it's... The novelist and the, you know, I think all civilized societies should have both, the novelist and the historian. And that sometimes, you know, they need to learn more from each other. I certainly couldn't have written this book without historians because I had to do a lot of research for which history was necessary. And a lot of the history books I found myself arguing with and wanting to throw across the room. But even that was illuminating because in the book there are people who carry views which I wouldn't, but I had to... When I was writing them, I had to believe and get inside their skin.
Towards the end of the novel, Hiroko declares that her life is not haunted by the past. Is that possible when you bear the scars of the past on your back throughout your life?
You know, I think people have very different ways of dealing with history and trauma. And I think Hiroko also, by the end, regrets the fact that she didn't sit and talk to her son about what happened to her and make him realize those costs of war. And I think she does regret that. But I think both she and her husband, Sajjad, are people who would say the best way to live is to not to forget the past or to pretend it never happened, but to keep your eyes forward, in a sense. But she's keeping her eyes forward while this thing is always at her back. And it's there more than she acknowledges.
You're often grouped with a new generation of writers who were born in Pakistan but live in England, such as Mohsin Hamid and Nadeem Aslam. Mm-hmm. Do you see a new school developing there? Because we've had, mm-hmm. to some degree, we've had this even earlier with people like Salman Rushdie, although he has decided that England is no longer the place he wants to live, and he now lives here.
Well, you know, it's a complicated business with England and the Pakistani writers. I only really started living there 2.5 years ago before that. And in fact, when I was writing this book, I was primarily based out of Pakistan. Mohsin Hamid, I think, is going to move back to Lahore quite soon. Mohammed Hanif, who wrote A Case of Exploding Mangoes, moved from London back to Karachi 2 years ago. Danial Moinuddin has just moved for a year from Pakistan to London. So there seems to be an awful lot of back and forth where it's not that we leave Pakistan and all move to London, but it seems to be instead back and forth and back and forth a lot between a group of us. It is, for me, really wonderful that there are now so many, I mean, not so many, but there are more Pakistani writers. When my first book was published in 1998, you know, no one really quite knew what to make of a Pakistani writer or what you were. But there is also the flip side, which is that people are interested in Pakistan now for the very worst reasons.
Well, not for the worst reason, just because Pakistan is so much in the news these days.
Well, I mean, the worst reasons in as much as because the country is going through a more difficult time, which is, you know, I wish it weren't, and that people were paying less attention to its writers. If that had to be the corollary, I'd take it.
Kamila Shamsi's latest novel, her fifth, is called Burnt Shadows. It is available in this country as a Picador paperback original, and I want to thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you very much.
Up next, Sir Harold Evans describes the changes he's seen over the course of his long career in journalism and what kind of role he thinks the press should play in our culture today. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.